content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Guardian, first, of February 15th, the Mormons want to save the Republican Party's soul, but is it too late? Mormon politicians have been some of Donald Trump's most vociferous detractors from the right. The Tea Party movement's first great scalp was three-term Senator Bob Bennett of Utah. Despite Bennett's staunch conservative credentials, Tea Party activists came to view Bennett, who supported a health care compromise with Democrats, as a sellout and a RINO, rhino, Republican in name only. The GOP's right wing targeted Bennett for a challenge in the primaries. In 2010, he was defeated, and his seat in the Senate was soon taken by a more hard-line Republican. In 2016, Bennett lay dying in a Virginia hospital, the victim of pancreatic cancer and a stroke that had left him partly paralyzed. In the last years of his life, Bennett had become convinced that there was something ugly and malignant growing in the Republican Party. As cancer ate away at Bennett's own body, he watched nativism, triumphalism, and hatred of compromise eat away at the party and turn it into something he barely recognized. He was particularly disturbed by Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslim immigration to the United States, which Bennett saw as immoral and incompatible with the tenets of his faith. An observant member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a scion of an influential Mormon political family, Bennett saw parallels between the historical persecution of Mormons, who were driven from state to state by anti-Mormon mobs, and Trump's rhetoric toward Muslims and Hispanic immigrants. "Are there any Muslims in the hospital?" the former senator asked his wife and sons shortly before he died, in a scene first reported by the Daily Beast. "I'd love to go up to every single one of them to thank them for being in this country and to apologize to them on behalf of the Republican Party for Donald Trump." On Thursday, Mitt Romney was expected to announce his candidacy for U.S. Senate from Utah, to the likely displeasure of President Trump, who reportedly worked the phones to try to block Romney, a frequent Trump foil, from running. Romney announced Wednesday he would delay his announcement in the wake of the Florida school shooting. One thing that Romney has in common with other conservative critics of the president? His religion. Mormon politicians have been some of Trump's most vociferous detractors, and not from the left. They include Evan McMullen, a former CIA officer and dogged Twitter critic of the Trump administration, who ran as an independent conservative candidate for president in 2016. McMullen took 21.54% of the vote in Utah, the only place where a third-party candidate came within striking distance of Trump or Clinton. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, who recently announced his retirement with a floor speech condemning Trump's attacks on the press, is also an observant Mormon, and even quoted a Mormon hymn in his speech. Many of the first national Republicans to disavow the famous Trump Access Hollywood tape were Trump politicians representing Mormon Belt states like Utah, Nevada, Idaho, and Arizona. The Deseret News, a Salt Lake newspaper owned by the Mormon Church, took the unprecedented step of calling for Trump to resign from the race. In an unusually strongly worded editorial, the newspaper described the tape as oozing evil and called upon Americans to, quote, take a clear stand against the hucksterism, misogyny, narcissism, and latent despotism that infect the Trump campaign. Mormon politicians were also among the first Republican politicians to condemn Roy Moore. While the national GOP poured money into Alabama to shore up Moore against competition from Democrat Doug Jones, Senator Jeff Flake proudly tweeted a picture of a check he had written to Jones. Country over party, Flake wrote in the memo. And Utah Congresswoman Mia Love, an observant Mormon, self-described Tea Party Republican and Haitian American, condemned Trump's alleged shithole remarks about poor countries. The willingness of Mormon-affiliated Republican politicians to publicly push back against Trump may seem surprising. Members of the Mormon Church, known for its conservative attitudes about sexuality and somewhat austere personal conduct it expects of members, are, statistically speaking, the most dependably Republican religious group in the country. In 2016, Pew reported that 70% of Mormons leaned Republican. and even the second closest choice of the groups polled, an evangelical Protestant sect, trailed at 63%. That still appeared to be the case last month when Gallup reported that 61% of Mormon voters nationally gave President Trump a positive approval rating, the highest of any religious bloc. In contrast, Trump's Gallup rating among Americans as a whole has recently hovered between 36 and 40%. This poll raises an enigmatic question, wrote Jack Davis, a student at the Mormon-affiliated Brigham Young University, in a recent op-ed for the Salt Lake Tribune. How does a politician so antithetical to Mormon belief receive such a broad stamp of approval? The difficult truth, he lamented, is that Mormons have seemingly decided that promoting a conservative agenda is more important than opposing Trump's reprehensible behavior. It appears that they are now willing to ignore the inexcusable in order to see certain legislation promoted. But if anything, the 61% number is likely surprisingly low. With a normal Republican president, I would expect his approval among Mormons to be in the high 70s, said political scientist Quinn Monson to the Deseret News. Monson also criticized the poll's methodology, which broke out Mormons as their own category, but lumped all Protestant sects together, meaning the responses of right-wing evangelical Protestants were averaged against those from more liberal Protestant denominations. The strange paradox among Mormons is that Mormons somehow seem to be simultaneously his strongest supporters and his fiercest critics. How? The Mormon Church rarely intervenes in politics. The last time it did, in support of California's Proposition 8 rescinding gay marriage, sparked a major backlash against the church and anger and distrust in the LGBT community that lingers to this day. But during the 2016 presidential campaign, the church took it the unusual step of issuing a statement reiterating its support for religious pluralism. Although the statement did not mention Trump, it was widely interpreted as a condemnation of his proposal to ban Muslim immigration. The statement quoted Joseph Smith, founder of Mormonism, as saying in 1843 that he would die in defense of, quote, any religious denomination who may be unpopular and too weak to defend themselves. The Mormon Church also has a significant Hispanic membership both in the U.S. and Latin America. The church itself has issued statements about immigration that are far more open to increased immigration and a more compassionate immigration system than the Republican Party currently is, said Jim Bennett, son of the late Senator Bennett. Then there's the simple matter of Trump's comportment as a politician and a human being. Trump's lewd behavior, including the infamous Access Hollywood tape, quote, demonstrate a personal morality that is at odds with Mormon culture, Bennett added. I think the reason Trump's approval rating among Mormons isn't higher is because a number of Mormons remain disgusted by who Trump is as a human being. Donald Trump is not a good husband, and that is a strong indictment in Mormonism, said Professor Kathleen Flake, a scholar of Mormon studies at the University of Virginia. He violates boundaries all over the place, and Mormons are very much about boundaries. She also noted that compared with conservative evangelicals, Mormons seem to be less focused on core right-wing issues like abortion or political dominance on the Supreme Court. Politically, Mormons might just be more invested in the character of their leaders than they are in specific issues, and perhaps just generally less invested in the culture war, she said. Trump's attitudes toward women also rub Mormons the wrong way. Mormon culture can be patriarchal, Jenna Reese said, a columnist in the Religion News Service, but that patriarchy manifests itself in holding women on pedestals as sweet and wonderful. In contrast, Trump's misogyny is hate-filled and obvious, like Trump himself. When Trump brags about going after married women and grabbing them, well, there is a respect for women in Mormonism that is quite old-fashioned, Professor Flake said. That old-fashionedness can strike one as paternalistic and sexist, depending on the circumstance, but it also reflects a sincere ethic of care toward women. In Salt Lake City, people still open doors for women. Mormonism, particularly in the western states, strongly encourages self-reliance, preparedness, and frugality, traits which would seem to translate naturally into support for the free market economics associated until recently with the GOP. On the one hand, Mormon culture tends to respond strongly to the Republican message that we don't need government, we just need religion and strong communities and the righteous individual, said Professor Flake. And Mormonism responds well in part because Mormons have historically had such a fraught relationship with government. But she said the flip side of that pioneer legacy is the belief in the importance of mutual aid and welfare provisions for the vulnerable. I think a sense of social duty is very strong with Mormons, she said, a kind of biblical communitarianism. In fact, one of the distinctive features of the Mormon Church is how much it redistributes wealth. All that tithing that goes into Salt Lake, a lot of that money goes to the half of the church that exists outside North America. That charitable instinct might be best exemplified by John Huntsman Sr., an industrialist turned philanthropist who died earlier this month. Huntsman, the father of John Huntsman Jr., the former presidential candidate and current U.S. ambassador to Russia, gave at least $1.5 billion to charity. He signed the Giving Pledge, which is made famous by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, which pressures the mega-wealthy to give at least half of their fortunes away, but criticized the pledge for not going nearly far enough. Never has a party so quickly or so easily abandoned its principles as my party did during this 2016 campaign, said Senator Jeff Flake in The Conscience of a Conservative, a recent book critiquing the state of the Republican Party. That line, as well as the book's title, a nod to the famous manifesto of the same name by arch-conservative Barry Goldwater, seemed to encapsulate the dilemma faced by Flake and other conservative critics of Trump. Principled conservatism is well and good, but does it still have a constituency? And is it possible to counter Trump, a political mud wrestler, without being dragged down to his level? For disaffected conservatives, Mormon and otherwise, the possibility of getting Mitt Romney into a Senate seat is a Hail Mary opportunity to pull the GOP back toward their vision of conservatism. As Kevin D. Williamson, editor of the Conservative National Review, has put it, for a certain kind of Republican, an increasingly rare kind, Mitt Romney is the one who got away, a representative of what the Republican Party might have become post-Obama if it had not become whatever it is the grotesque and stunted political corporation still pretending to be the party of Lincoln has become. But, Williamson suggests, it might be too late. If Republicans were who they were 10 years ago, a Romney renaissance might make perfect sense, but Republicans have changed. For some Mormon conservatives, the Republican is too far gone. McMullen, the third-party conservative who challenged Trump and Clinton in 2016, believes both major parties are going to move further and further to the extremes. He has started an organization, Stand Up Republic, which he hopes can pressure American politics to move back toward the mainstream or form the infrastructure of an eventual third party. We believe it is necessary for those who are not aligned with the far left or the far right, people who are still interested in liberal democracy, in a free society, in an enterprising but inclusive society, to seek an alternative. Jim Bennett, son of Senator Bennett, recently resigned his membership in the GOP to help build a local third party, United Utah. It was clear to me from my father's example that you cannot remain loyal to the Republican Party while Donald Trump is in charge of it. Other Republicans have reached a different conclusion. They think there are ways to separate the odiousness of the man from what politically the party can accomplish. But from my perspective, and I believe from my father's perspective, the two are so intertwined that you can't come away undiminished from an association with him. And now from The Economist of February 12th, China's price. Catholics argue over the value of a breakthrough deal with China. For some, a Vatican-China agreement carries a moral cost. Tough public arguments, including some colorful name-calling, are going on between influential figures in the Catholic Church, not this time about the status of divorcees who remarry or any other pastoral or theological conundrum, but about China. For decades, two separate structures have practiced Catholicism in China. One is the Chinese Patriotic Catholic Association, CPCA, established by the Beijing authorities in 1957 and unrecognized by the Vatican. The other is the long-persecuted, semi-clandestine church headed by bishops who are canonically ordained by Rome. This situation reflects China's refusal to host institutions which defer to a foreign authority, and Rome's belief that only its blessing can make a bishop legitimate. As the prospects emerge of a historic diplomatic breakthrough between the Holy See and China, two very different impulses are in conflict. One is the anti-communist tradition of speaking truth to atheist power, whatever the price. The other is a more pragmatic way of thinking, which accepts trade-offs in the hope of a huge geopolitical prize. On February 9th, an 86-year-old Chinese prelate, Cardinal Joseph Zen, lamented that the Vatican was behaving, quote, unfaithfully, by preparing a bargain that would put 12 million Chinese believers in a, quote, birdcage controlled by the communist authorities. In recent months, the outspoken cardinal, who is relatively free to speak thanks to his location in Hong Kong, has alleged that poison has infected the mind of the Vatican's top diplomats and asserted that the Pope is not always fully informed. He's described the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, as a man of little faith. This has earned him several rebukes from the Vatican, most recently on February 7th, when he was scolded for fostering confusion and controversy about the state and future of Sino-Catholic relations. Cardinal Zen is the loudest critic of an impending deal. He says this will involve bishops being selected in practice by the Chinese government, endorsed by some notionally self-governing procedure, and then only at the final stage subject to veto from Rome. This would give Rome at least a semblance of control and allow it to recognize those prelates. Cardinal Zen said this arrangement would be fraud, and the Holy See would be reluctant to use its veto power. They, the Chinese government, say the last word belongs to the Holy Father. Sounds wonderful, but it's fake, he declared. Among people in Cardinal Zen's camp, the impending deal is seen as a betrayal of the clerics who endured years of torment for their loyalty to Rome and to the principle of papal authority. To prepare the way for a deal, some of the old guard bishops are being asked to step aside in favor of prelates who enjoy Beijing's approval. Unhappiness about the impending deal is also reflected in some articles carried by AsiaNews.it, a well-connected Catholic news agency which covers regional politics from Baghdad to Beijing. A recent report described how an 88-year-old prelate of the old persecuted generation broke down in tears when asked by a Vatican delegation to step down in favor of a bishop who enjoyed Beijing's blessing. The elderly man did not object to retiring, but hated yielding his position to a state-endorsed figure. Meanwhile, the editor-in-chief of AsiaNews.it, Father Bernardo Cervellera, has had a colorful public spat with an influential Rome-based Argentine bishop who praised China's social and environmental policies and said the communist state was the best implementer of the Vatican's social doctrine. Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo, Chancellor of the Pontifical Academies of Sciences and Social Sciences, had lauded Beijing for, quote, defending the dignity of the person and avoiding the influence of business over politics, which exists, say, in America. Father Cervellera retorted that such utopian naivete risked becoming an embarrassment for the church. When my friends tell me they are going to China, I always advise them not to stop at the shopping centers, the ultra-luxury hotels, and the skyscrapers, but to go out to the peripheries to get a better picture of real China, he wrote. The Argentine's rosy-eyed impressions took no account of the Chinese authorities' ruthless clearances of poor neighborhoods, or indeed of religious persecution. One does not have to share the Argentine bishop's gushing enthusiasm to see how a breakthrough with China was enticing for the Vatican. Pope Francis has said he would like to visit that country. But as many Western countries are discovering, Beijing does not offer free lunches. And from the Associated Press now of February 17th, ancient beard traditions shape the face of modern Jerusalem. Facial hair is trendy worldwide these days, but in Jerusalem, beards have never gone out of style, projecting religious mysticism, nationalism, and ideals of masculinity. For men of all faiths in the Holy City, a beard can be an important statement of religious devotion, connecting past generations to God through the tangled strands of history. Facial hair also reflects social mores in many communities. In some cases, it can even reflect one's political views. Nowhere is this more visible than in Jerusalem's Old City, where the bearded all come into contact in a densely packed mix of some of the world's most sensitive holy sites. For Eitan Press, age 40, growing a beard is a spiritual journey that embodies ancient concepts of Jewish mysticism while challenging modern perceptions of masculinity. His beard balm company, Aleph Male, is more than clever wordplay on the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. He says it expresses Jewish values that stand in sharp contrast to the tough alpha male narrative often associated with facial hair. Rather than being a man at the top of the pyramid, it's the image of a man who is lifting his brothers up, said Press, who has a majestic, full red beard. When a man grows a beard, it is incumbent upon him to act with greater kindness, compassion, and sensitivity toward the world, because he is now wearing on his face a divine quality. At Jerusalem's bustling Mahane Yehuda market, he demonstrated his unique blends on a recent day, anointing bearded shoppers with balms inspired by Jewish festivals and rites. One conjures up the citrus notes of Sukkot, the autumn festival that commemorates the desert wandering of the Jews during the Exodus. Items like myrtle branches and the etrog, which is a fruit resembling a lemon, are used in ceremonies. Another blend has aromas of clove and cinnamon, spices used in Havdalah, the ritual marking the end of the Sabbath and the beginning of the new week. Jewish beard culture is literally thousands of years old. Moses had a beard. King David had a beard, he said. The custom for Jewish men to anoint their hair and beards with sacred oil goes back to the Bible. The custom of religious Jews wearing beards is rooted in a passage in the biblical book of Leviticus that forbids, quote, destroying beard edges and prohibits shaving with a blade. And while Jewish law permits the use of electric razors or scissors to trim beards, some sects don't shave at all. Michael Silber, a Hebrew University professor who has researched beards, said that some Orthodox Jewish communities, leaning on Jewish mystical texts, consider facial hair so holy that men refrain from even combing their beards, fearing that they will pull hair out. Strands that fall out naturally are sometimes placed in prayer books for preservation, he said. For the pious that follow such teachings, beards are a channel of divinity, connecting them to God, he said. And beards cross religious lines. Zuhair Dubai, an Islamic scholar and imam in the West Bank city of Nablus, said that while Muslim men grow beards for religious reasons, mustaches are rooted in popular culture. Some grow mustaches to emulate powerful leaders, like Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, he said. Some autocratic governments in the Mideast were known to shave off a prisoner's mustache as a form of humiliation, Dubai said. In Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, some men swear by their mustache, putting their hand on it to convince people to accept their word, Dubai said. Muslim beard traditions stem from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, who in the 7th century urged his followers to wear beards and to shorten the mustache as a sign of modesty. They regained popularity in modern times with the rise of political Islam about 3 decades ago. Some Muslims tint their beards orange with henna, which may have been used by the Prophet. Among Orthodox Christian priests, long bushy beards are as common as a sight as their long flowing robes on the narrow, winding cobblestone streets of Jerusalem's ancient old city. They see a beard as a sign of devotion to God and homage to Jesus, traditionally portrayed with a beard. In Jerusalem, wearing a beard can also reflect political statements. In the 1980s, religion begins to be intertwined with political orientations, and this is reflected with the rise of the beard among the more right-wing oriented and religiously oriented, both Jews and Muslims, Silver said. Many bearded men, of course, often have simpler motives and just like the style. Tal Johnson, a barber in the Israeli city of Holon, said growing one is not as easy as it looks. You can't eat with it. There are lots of things that are terrible, like hummus, a fried egg that's runny, and you need to wash it afterwards. All of this is very complicated. Eating soup is awful, he said. For Heath Loftus, an American visiting Jerusalem, it has a different meaning altogether. I grew the beard after my time in the Marine Corps, he said. We always had to keep our face shaved, so I grew it out now as a freedom, but also as a tribute to that time in the Marine Corps. And also from the Associated Press, of February 16th, I believe. The Pope, Pope Francis, has revived his lapsed sex abuse advisory commission by naming new members on Saturday after coming under fire for his overall handling of the scandal and his support for a Chilean bishop accused by victims of witnessing and ignoring their abuse. The announcement of the new members of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors came on the same day that a Vatican investigator will take the testimony in New York of one of the main whistleblowers in the Chilean cover-up scandal. Francis tasked Archbishop Charles Cicluna with the fact-finding mission into Bishop Juan Barros after he came under blistering criticism in Chile for defending Barros and calling the victim's cover-up accusations against him slander. The initial three-year mandate of the commission members had lapsed 2 months ago, on December 17th. Francis named nine new members Saturday and kept seven from the initial group. A Vatican statement said survivors of abuse are included, but didn't identify them to protect their privacy. None of the most outspoken lay advocates for victims from the original group returned, but a statement stressed that the commission's work would be imbued throughout with the experience of victims. Commission members are to open their April plenary by meeting with victims privately, and discussions are continuing to create an international survivor advisory panel to advise the commission to make sure the voices of victims are heard in all its deliberations, the statement said. Francis created the commission in December of 2013, responding to complaints that he hadn't prioritized the fight against clerical abuse and cover up enough. The group's mission was to advise the Pope on best practices to protect children, but it faced strong in-house resistance to some of its core proposals. Commission members found greater reception in hosting grassroots workshops in bishops' conferences around the world. To date, this has worked with almost 200 dioceses and religious communities worldwide to raise awareness and to educate staff on safeguarding. The first members of the commission were named in 2014, March, including Marie Collins, an Irish survivor of abuse and advocate for victims. But by March of last year, Collins had resigned, citing the unacceptable resistance to the commission from within the Vatican, and in particular the office tasked with investigating sex abuse cases. The commission's most significant proposal came in 2015 when it successfully persuaded Francis and his kitchen cabinet to create a tribunal section inside the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to judge bishops who botched handling cases of their abuser priests. Francis approved funding and personnel for an initial five-year term. But amid resistance, the tribunal never got off the ground, and Francis scrapped it entirely in 2016. Instead, he issued a document laying out essentially existing procedures for the Vatican to investigate negligence. There was no transparency in the process, however. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.